Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the Rimini meeting for friendship among peoples takes place here in the Italian resort city this week. We'll be hearing from two key speakers, an expert on the evolution creation debate and the Vatican's representative to the UN in Geneva. And as British Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor marks his 80th birthday, he shares some of his memories of the Second Vatican Council, which opened its doors half a century ago this October. The so-called conflict between faith and science, or more precisely between evolutionary biology and a belief in God the Creator, came under the spotlight this week at the Rimini meeting for friendship amongst peoples. The week-long annual encounter taking place in the northern Italian resort city brings together international experts on religion, politics, economics, science and the arts to debate cutting-edge issues and promote dialogue between different cultures. Amongst the speakers addressing the crucial questions of faith and science was Professor William Carroll from the Theology Faculty of Oxford University. During a quiet moment in the conference, he spoke to me about the way in which evolutionary biology is often hijacked by those seeking to promote a secular and exclusive understanding of the origins of our human nature. This issue of evolution versus creation, if you like, remains a very hotly debated subject with all kinds of political and cultural overtones, doesn't it? In your view, is there anything about evolutionary biology with which Catholics, Christians should have a problem?
No. The problem comes with a kind of evolutionism, as they say in Italian, evoluzionismo, with a kind of evolutionism in which evolutionary biology is used as the basis for broad philosophical and cultural claims which contend, for example, that human beings are nothing other than the process of biological change, that the natural sciences in general and biology in particular tell us all there needs to be known about what it means to be a human being. Such claims which tell us that the natural sciences, and in particular biology, tell us everything about what it means to be human, those are philosophical and to some extent theological, but especially philosophical claims, and not themselves claims justified by the developments in evolutionary biology. So the dilemma comes from a kind of what I would call totalizing naturalism, in which the natural sciences tell us everything that needs to be known about nature, about human nature, and so forth. And the problem then of some conflict with traditional philosophy and theology with respect to human nature, with respect to creation, the problem comes when one has an unjustified philosophical judgment about the nature and extent of evolutionary biology.
This debate, though, has divided scientists and theologians for centuries, hasn't it? Even before Darwin and the developments of the 17th century. Do you see many parallels between reactions in medieval Christianity, the medieval church, to Aristotle's science and contemporary reactions to Darwin and more modern theories of evolution?
Well, in the Middle Ages, especially in medieval Islam, and to some degree Judaism and Christianity as well, there were a number of theologians and philosophers in each of the traditions who felt threatened by any number of conclusions based upon the advanced science of the day, which was an Aristotelian science. In particular concerning the eternity of the world. And that's but one example. And the concern was, what do we do in the face of scientific claims that the world is eternal in the light of Christian belief or Muslim belief or Jewish belief that the world has a temporal beginning? So for some, the solution to this apparent conflict was to reject or to ban the teaching of Aristotelian science. This was attempted already in the 13th century in the Latin West at different universities. But it was the genius of thinkers such as Albert the Great, St. Bonaventure, and in particular of Thomas Aquinas, to show that Aristotelian science need not be construed as a threat to traditional Christian belief, especially with respect to the notion of creation. And Thomas helped us to see that the natural sciences, in his case Aristotelian science, offers explanation of processes which occur in nature, whereas creation is an account of why there is anything at all. In other words, creation is an account of the existence of things, whereas the natural sciences offer explanations about changes in and among existing things, even if those changes involve long processes, and for Thomas, even if the world were eternal. Because although Thomas believed that the world had a temporal beginning, he thought that an eternal universe, if the universe were eternal, an eternal universe would still be a created universe. So in many ways, the manner in which thinkers such as Thomas Aquinas wrestled with the implications of Aristotelian science for belief in creation, for example, can continue to serve as a useful way to look at claims about nature and human nature based on developments in the biological sciences. In particular, with respect to creation, Thomas helps us to see that creation isn't some distant event. It is rather the ongoing, complete causing of all that is. And whatever kind of universe we have, even if the universe were eternal or an evolving universe or whatever, the kind of universe we have is a different question from the fact that whatever kind of universe there is, God is the creative cause of that universe. So the dilemma that Thomas helps us to resolve is to think that creation must mean some particular literalistic reading of Scripture, or it must mean God's acting over against natural processes and the like, and that therefore there would be some kind of conflict between accepting the tenets of evolutionary biology and the tenets of the doctrine of creation. Thomas says that what's crucial to reading Genesis is the fact of creation, not the manner or mode of formation of the world. And the natural sciences talk about the manner or mode of formation of the world, not whether or not the world is created.
But if Thomas and others are offering these insights, these solutions, as you call them, so many centuries ago, why is it that some scientists and indeed some theologians today continue to see it as either or?
Well, what has happened, especially in the 19th and 20th centuries, especially after Darwin, but already to some extent before, is that evolution and creation, broadly construed, have taken on sort of cultural connotations. They become ideological markers for competing worldviews. And the conflict really exists between competing worldviews, which have their roots in particular scientific or particular philosophical conceptions, and it's those competing worldviews which are in conflict. But once one begins to unpack the arguments behind these competing worldviews and allows the natural sciences to say, well, what is the nature and what are the limits of natural scientific explanation, then one can begin to reduce, if not indeed eliminate, some of these apparent conflicts. In a world in which science has taken on the sort of preeminent authority or marker for truth, it becomes easy to make the mistake to think that the natural sciences explain all that needs to be explained. And as I suggested before, that claim that the natural sciences explain all that needs to be explained leads some on the part of, in the name of natural science, to reject theological and philosophical notions of creation, and it leads some on the other side, in order to defend traditional beliefs in creation, to think that one must reject the conclusions of the natural sciences. But that conflict as I said, is in part the result of a kind of misunderstanding of the nature and extent of scientific inquiry, what Pope Benedict XVI calls the narrowing of reason simply to the realm of the natural sciences, and hence the narrowing of explanations only to the realm of the natural sciences. Another reason for the failure to take seriously judgments of people like Thomas Aquinas on this matter is the sort of master narrative of modernity, which sees the modern world being born as in part a rejection of the thought of Thomas and Aristotle. And how do we know that? Because the scientific revolution of the 17th century has shown us that that philosophy and science of Thomas and of Aristotle is false, because modern science is true, etc. So the only reason to look to Thomas Aquinas at all would be for sort of archaeological purposes, to examine the fossils of an extinct intellectual species. But if we begin to think again about the relationship between traditional science and contemporary science, we might be able to see ways to reappropriate, as the French say, ressourcement, to reappropriate the thought of Thomas Aquinas, because he helps us to make these crucial distinctions between creation and the natural sciences. As he often said, creatio non est mutatio. Creation isn't a change. And creation is right now. Creation is the complete ongoing causing of whatever is. Creation is a kind of vertical dimension in the affairs of the world, whereas the natural sciences explain all the changes on a kind of horizontal plane. This was an image, indeed, which I think Pope Benedict XVI has made on several occasions, that the natural sciences and the human sciences in general concern the horizontal level of existence, whereas creation is that vertical dimension which, in a way, makes the horizontal possible.
And finally, do you see a growing acceptance of this position, of this way in which creation and evolutionary biology can go hand in hand, or are you concerned about a hardening of positions against this view?
Well, it is always sort of more exciting for the popular press and even for popular writers, including scientists, to embrace some sort of fundamental conflict between science and religion, between evolution and creation. That sort of mythology persists because it serves valuable ideological roles. In other words, as one argues in questions of bioethics or all sorts of stem cell research, whatever, all those sorts of contemporary hot-button issues, it becomes easy to use as an ideological club in debate the notion of a fundamental conflict, of a fundamental hostility. So there is, since the view of a conflict continues to serve a number of important political and social purposes, it becomes difficult to dislodge that notion of a conflict from public consciousness.
Professor William Carroll there, the Thomas Aquinas Fellow in Science and Religion based at Blackfriars Hall in Oxford University. Also addressing the Rimini meeting, which draws to a close this weekend, was the Holy See's permanent representative to the United Nations in Geneva, Archbishop Silvano Tomasi. He spoke about the need for justice as the root of democracy and the search for common values that can overcome conflict, discrimination, and persecution of minority communities.
I think the topic is very timely because most societies today are becoming more and more pluralistic. In this context, to find a way of living together and peacefully becomes a challenge. And therefore, we need to devise and discover some basic values that can allow each one of us to be himself or herself, and at the same time, beyond our differences, to have something in common that will allow the possibility of living together in a constructive and positive and creative way. The challenge, of course, is to identify these values. I would say that given the context of the differences and the variety of convictions, religious beliefs, opinions, we need to fall back on what we have in common, that is our nature and our reason, two resources that even Pope Benedict refers to regularly, namely the fact that we are all human beings, give us a chance to respect each other and to identify in our common dignity the point of departure for developing laws and rights that are really in line with the plan of creation, the nature that God has given us. And it is by respecting the nature, the reality, without escaping into ideologies, that we find the path that leads to a constructive future.
And what about the persecution of Christians all around the world, especially we think in these times in Pakistan and in Nigeria?
We are very often talking about democracy and respect of general principles, but in reality there is a big contradiction between what some state constitutions that guarantee freedom for everybody and the practice of life shows. We have around the world plenty of evidence documented by surveys, by reports done by either UN special rapporteurs or by other government institutions that have investigated this issue. We have plenty of evidence that the group that is most threatening the free exercise of its rights are the Christians. And we can look at the bombs used against churches in Nigeria or Kenya, against people in the Middle East, Iraq, Afghanistan even, where there are very few believers. Because the intolerance against religious minorities is not limited to Christians. Other religious minorities are also persecuted or attacked because of their beliefs, of their different traditions. So what we need to do is to start educating in schools, for example, using textbooks that are free from hate, instead of having, as happens in some countries, that you have textbooks that teach hate of people of different religions. I think we need to make an extraordinary effort to convince and create a different public understanding that our differences should not lead to conflict, but should lead to more dialogue. And it becomes also more and more evident that the intolerance that is increasing is not just only based on conflict or bonds, but it also is based on more subtle strategies, like the attempt to eliminate the influence of persons with religious convictions from contributing to the common good by participating in public life. So instead of having the understanding that is projected by some medias that religion, especially Christianity, is limiting the freedom of individuals, we should take notice that it's the other way around, that certain forms of ideology are preventing the free exercise of religion on the part of Christians, Catholics in particular. So we need to work together to create a society that is more open, more tolerant, and more appreciative of the common dignity that each one of us has.
Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva, talking to Vatican Radio's Deborah Donini. British Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor celebrates his 80th birthday on Friday, a milestone which means he will no longer vote in any future conclave and will cease his active membership of both the Congregation for Bishops and the Congregation for the Evangelization of Peoples, which he has served since 2009. The former Archbishop of Westminster is, however, going to be kept busy over the coming months. In November this year, he'll travel to Bangladesh as the papal legate to celebrate the 125th anniversary of the creation of the Diocese of Dhaka and the 400th anniversary of the presence of the Christian faith in that region of South Asia. Back home in Britain, meanwhile, he was born in Reading in August 1932, Cardinal Cormac remains the UK's most senior Catholic figure, speaking out on the important role of religion in the public square and sharing his great experience of ecumenism, which began half a century ago in the wake of the Second Vatican Council.
It goes back a long way. I think I was rector here at the English College for 6 years, and the last years of Pope Paul VI of blessed memory. And my ecumenical relationships really began then. I hosted the Archbishop of Canterbury here, Archbishop Coggan, in 1977. And then after the Pope John Paul's visit to Britain in 1982, I was appointed as co-chairman of something called ARCIC, the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission. And from then on, I was intimately involved in visits of the Archbishops of Canterbury to Rome, ongoing relationships with the Anglican Communion, as well as with not only the theological aspects, which ARCIC dealt with, but also the more human friendships which grew up during those years.
Since his days as the Archbishop of Westminster, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor has been a regular guest on our English programme. During one of his most recent visits to Rome, I sat down with him to talk about the Second Vatican Council, which opened on October the 11th, 1962. The 50th anniversary of that three-year landmark meeting of bishops will be celebrated in many ways in different countries around the globe, in particular here in the Vatican in October, as bishops gather once again for a synod on the need for new evangelization to promote the gospel message half a century on from Vatican II. So let's take a step back in time now to that exciting moment just as the council was about to begin, as Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor shares with us some of his memories of Vatican II, beginning with his recollections of the anticipation in the air in the autumn of 1962.
Well, I was an assistant priest at the time in Portsmouth, but I do remember being very excited by the prospect of the council and the wonderful Pope John, who captivated the world, really, with his humility and naturalness and humour, and his taking the very brave step of having a council. I mean, from all my studies, you know, councils happen every few hundred years, so this was something not only significant, but something very exciting. We really didn't know what was going to occur. And so I followed the council very closely, especially the four great documents on liturgy and the church and revelation. And of course, when I became a bishop, I took as my motto, Gaudium et Spes, the church and the modern world.
Why were you particularly attracted to that document, to that particular theme, if you like?
Well, because I thought that, speaking in a way simplistically, that the council brought both a great deal of joy to people and a new approach of the Catholic Church to the world in which we live, and also a hope for people. That I always thought hope, one of the three theological virtues, which is not understood enough. You don't know about faith, and we know about charity, but hope. Hope is something, it brings meaning to life. So I thought then, and if we talk about the council, then yes, it did bring a lot of joy, and also hope for the future.
What effects did it have directly on the church in England, as you remember it, in the weeks, the months, the years after the council?
I suppose the most immediate effect was the liturgy, especially, obviously, the change in the language from Latin to English, and the sense in which there was a genuine participation of lay people, and the mystery of the liturgy, the Mass in particular, was opened up for people in a new way. So I think that was the first effect. And then other things, it took longer to understand, I mean, especially the document on the church, which talked about the people of God, and the church, which was not just about hierarchy, it was about mystery, it was about communio, communion. And then, of course, for me, when the document on ecumenism came out, which was really a follow-up to the document on the church, well, I read that avidly, really, and I remember the words, which indeed, years ago, I more or less learnt by heart. There's no ecumenism worthy of the name without interior conversion, newness of attitudes, and unstinted love. And I've taken that as my kind of motto, newness of attitudes. You know, we have to look on our fellow Christians as people with whom we share such a lot. Newness of attitude, conversion of heart, because we used to kind of suspect them, you know, and we grew up, well, the Catholic Church was it. The Protestant Church, whatever its form, was not it. But now we were encouraged to pray together, to be together, to try and grow in communion together. And that was a great change. And unstinted love, and actually to be friends with our fellow Christians, and in as much as we're able to witness together. And that affected me then very, very much. I was by that time working with one of the bishops, our Archbishop Warlock, as his secretary, as his chaplain. And so I had to deal with that at first hand.
He was a great ecumenist, of course, himself, wasn't he?
Well, he was. I mean, when he left, I was with him when he was Bishop of Portsmouth, but particularly when we went to Liverpool, he and Bishop David Shepherd, the Anglican bishop, they were a great partnership. Now, that's the sort of thing that should be happening everywhere. And I must say that the effect of the council with regard to inter-church relations, especially in England with the Anglicans, despite the theological difficulties, which are very real, I think the friendship and the growing awareness that we must witness together in so many fields, especially in an increasing secular society, that's been very important.
My thanks there to Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, former Archbishop of Westminster, who marks his 80th birthday this Friday. For now, that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.